Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. I have been off for a while. Work commitments and other things have kept my attention, but what a way for us to come back with, I would consider, a legend and an illustrious guest, someone that I have admired from a distance as I journeyed through higher education myself. And she is an inspiration to many. And quite honestly, I am humbled and beside myself today that I have this opportunity to speak with her. So ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week, Dr. Janetta Cole. Dr. Cole, how are you?
I am well, my brother, and thank you. Thank you for the honor and the joy of joining you in this conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Well, as we said off air, we have no preset questions. I'll just ask an open-ended question to start. There are some other facts and other things that I've garnered, but as based on your responses, I'll just have derivative questions, and before you know it, our time will be gone. Is that okay?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, all right. So let's just jump in. The open-ended question is, who is Dr. Janetta Cole? What undergirds her early years, growing up, family, the nucleus, if you will, of the family, and undergird her for her early years all the way through to where she is today? Who is Dr. Janetta Cole?
Well, I do believe that each of us is in many ways who we belong to. Each of us is in many ways what our life experiences from a very early age have set us to be. So let me put me back there in those really wretched days of legal segregation, of racism in brutal and unrelenting force. As I came into the world in a place called Jacksonville, Florida, born as a cis girl, born as an African American, but I was not born poor. In fact, I was born into a wealthy Black family whose patriarch was Abraham Lincoln, Lewis.
Yes, ma'am.
And so my great-grandfather, bearing that name of Abraham Lincoln, was born in 1865 in Madison County, Florida. His parents were Judy and Robert Lewis, who had recently themselves been freed from enslavement. And so they chose the name of Abraham Lincoln for this son who was born in 1865. He only had an elementary school education. But my great-grandfather was a man of faith. He had an incredible sense of his responsibility to others. And he worked very hard against extraordinary odds. In 1901, Abraham Lincoln Lewis and six other Black men founded the Afro-American Industrial and Benefit Association. Now, my brother Gerald, I have thought a lot about this. Where in the world did my great-grandfather get that Afrocentric language from? Because he was the one who named this organization that went on to become the Afro-American Life Insurance Company. He could have named it the Colored Life Insurance Company. He could have named it the Negro Life Insurance Company. He had such a sense of where he had come from and whose he was. Mm-hmm. He chose that name. Well, as he became a millionaire and in a leadership role of the Afro-American Life Insurance Company, my great-grandfather in 1935 founded, or better put, was the lead executive in founding the very historic American Beach community where my husband and I now live. So what does all this mean? Well, one of my favorite stories, and I just finished writing about this, one of my favorite stories to capture what it meant to grow up as the great-granddaughter of Abraham Lincoln Lewis is this. My mother, who at a given point was indeed an educator, she taught English at Edward Waters, now Edward Waters University. She was a registrar there. She went on to be an officer in the family's insurance company. But sometimes my mother would get a phone call. And on the other end, the white woman wouldn't say, "Hello, Annie." As Black women, fully grown Black women, were disrespectfully addressed. The white woman would say, "Mrs. Betch, we've just gotten in some really nice new dresses at our downtown department store. Bring the daughters down after we close and let them try them on." Wow. Why would they go to the store after the store was closed? Because, of course, Black people could not try on clothes in department stores. And so one evening, as we were driving back home, I said to my mom, "Mama," and I must have been around 9 or 10 years old, "Mama, please, if I can't try on clothes in the light of day, please don't ever make me go to that store again and try on clothes in the darkness of night." And my mother looked at me and at my sister, who was 18 months older than I. Our younger brother had not yet come into the world. And she said, "I hear you. I hear you. We will not do this again. Ever again." So our clothes would either be brought home, and if they didn't fit, taken down and exchanged in the light of day. Or when we traveled north, they would be bought in the light of day. That is how I became, I am convinced, that is my first adventure into the world of being a social justice activist. I'll leave it at there at that, my brother, because of course there are other stories about how I became an educator or a museum director or a diversity, equity, accessibility, and inclusion professional.
Thank you for that story. That's very intriguing. One derivative question from that. I read somewhere that your mom and Mary McLeod Bethune and another lady who was the librarian at Fisk University, I think her name is Anna, they were heavy influences on your life and your journey. Would you say the story you just shared of the department store with your mom and that being your entrance, if you will, into social justice, how did these three ladies enliven, if you will, that desire, if at all?
Well, in many ways, so much of my life does circle back to Abraham Lincoln Lewis. My great-grandfather, who was an extraordinary philanthropist, in addition to being a businessman, had a very close professional relationship and friendship with the legendary Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune. He asked her, and she agreed, to serve on the board of Edward Waters, then Edward Waters College, where A.L. Lewis was on the board. She convinced him to serve on the board of Bethune-Cookman College, where she was the president. And so it was through my great-grandfather that my nuclear family, my father, my mother, my sister, myself, and not my brother, he was 9 years younger than I, came to know Dr. Bethune. My mother had two very close girlfriends, both of whom, like her, were Deltas. And so she would want often to visit them. One was the librarian, Miss Burrell. Mm-hmm. The other was a professor of languages, Romance languages, Miss Spate. And so my sister and I would be put in the car and my mom would drive us to Daytona from Jacksonville. If the amazing Dr. Bethune was in her office, as youngsters, we would have the privilege of going to see her.
Wow.
Little could I have even imagined that years and years and years later, I would have the privilege, the honor, the joy of serving as the president and the chair of the board of one of the organizations that Dr. Bethune founded, namely the National Council of Negro Women.
So Dr. Cole, as you think about those drives from Jacksonville to Daytona and meeting with Dr. Bethune, how do you weave a thread as you look backwards? Did that meeting her spark even a greater fire within you? Because as I look at your career and the educator and museum director and president of the National Council of Negro Women and all those things, when I looked at your bio and I've watched you from a distance, you've always found a way to weave education in with the social aspects of our being. And with Dr. Bethune founding or having a college named after her, does that tie a bind that kept you going in this space? I find it very interesting because of your career and the impact you yourself has had on so many people.
Well, I don't think there's any question about how I am centered. One of the ways in which I am centered is that I think I am fundamentally a teacher and a learner. And I use that language quite purposefully because I think if one teaches but does not learn, then half of what is to be has not happened. Mm. If one learns but does not teach, again, only half of what is to happen has taken place. I love proverbs, particularly African proverbs. There's one that says, "She who learns must teach, and she who teaches must learn." And so, even though I was a youngster when I had that extraordinary experience of knowing Dr. Bethune, I was mature enough to know that I was in the presence of greatness, that she was no ordinary woman, not just by what I knew about her, could read about her, my mother told me about her. To be in her presence was to feel that one was in the presence of one of the great women of the world. And so I continue to read about Dr. Bethune, to do my best to have some semblance of my own work and action in sync with hers. There's a very, very special book that will be published, I think, in the fall, written by an extraordinary Spelman alumna, Noelle Rooks, who is now in the academic world herself. She's at Brown University in African American Studies. Oh, I have to get this copy and show it to you because I want you to see. Can you see that cover?
Yes, ma'am.
Look at that image of Dr. Bethune.
That is striking.
Very, very young Dr. Bethune. And Noelle entitled her book, A Passionate Mind in Relentless Pursuit, The Vision of Mary McLeod Bethune. So much of my life is not just that I'm in the process of reading the book and I got to hurry because the deadline is coming to get my blurb in the back of the book. But I would say that she really does continue to be a force in ordering my steps.
Mm-hmm. So
my bro, let us remember that in addition to founding the National Council of Negro Women, in addition to founding Bethune-Cookman, Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune was a co-founder of the United Negro College Fund.
Yes, ma'am. She was right there with Mr. Patterson, F.D. Patterson.
That's true.
Yes, I know the history of UNCF well, spending some time there myself. But everything you just said about Dr. Bethune, I could say the same for you, Dr. Cole. I honestly could say that. I'm just sitting here talking with you today. But when you think of your own journey, your own educational journey, growing up there in Jacksonville and having the experiences that you've had, would you have considered yourself from a very early age the scholar that you are today? Were you that focused academically or on your scholarly pursuits, if you will, at a young age? Or was that something expected in the home? And, you know, you took all the way through and you went to Fisk University. So what was the expectations, if you will, for education, and more importantly, education tied to social entrepreneurship, if you will?
Well, I'm fond of saying that my parents believed in education like the devil believes in sin. And so they sent me off to the first grade when I was only 5 years old.
Oh, wow, okay.
When I was 15, I was told, and in those days, one did basically what one was told to do by one's parents.
Mm-hmm.
I was told by my parents that I was to go downtown in Jacksonville and take a test. If I passed the test, I would not go to the 12th grade of high school. I would go to Fisk University in an early entrance program. Now, my brother, I did not want to do that. I had just gone to Stanton High School the first time. I was in a non-all-girls school where I had been in my middle school years.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be at Stanton. I was in the band. I had a new group of friends. So all I had to do, since I didn't want to go to Fisk, was to go downtown and check all the wrong answers. But being the A type that I was, I checked all the right answers. And so off I went to Fisk at the age of 15.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the explanation for this is that my parents were atypical for Black folk of that era. They were both college graduates. Both had gone to UNCF member institutions. My mother to Wilberforce, then Wilberforce College, now university. My father to Knox College. And so even though my great-grandfather and my grandfather were not college graduates, they were very well-educated individuals. And my parents were formally educated. And so that helps to explain, I think, my own early and deep engagement in the world of education.
So that's a fascinating story. So from Fisk, you ended up at Oberlin. So you transferred. Was that something that you also wanted to do, or you were told to do that?
Well, that was the year, my year at Fisk, of the greatest trauma of my life up to that point. That was the year when unexpectedly my father went to glory. Mm. And with the passing of my father, I experienced trauma as I had never known it. And my mother, in cahoots with my older sister, who was at Oberlin, double major in voice and piano in the conservatory, said that I needed to be near family. And so they urged me to leave Fisk and to go to Oberlin. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, I am the product of one of our great historically Black universities and an extraordinary PWI, because Oberlin was the first college in the United States to accept African Americans and the first college in the United States to accept women. It, in many ways, those two institutions shaped my educational journey and much of my life's journey.
Mm-hmm. So in the field of sociology, your undergrad was there, but then you moved to anthropology, and you're known for all of the work that you've done in both spaces. Were those that the selection of that major for undergrad, and then where you will focus your post-grad efforts and doctoral efforts, is that still part of this journey that you were a part of, that you got introduced to at such an early age?
Well, I've told this story many times, but a good story is worth telling a lot.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
I had gone to Oberlin and to Fisk before, saying absolutely in response to that question that the old folks love, even to this day, to put to youngsters. So when you grow up, what do you want to be? Yes. My answer from the days when I was knee-high to a duck was, I'm going to be a baby doctor.
Yes.
Well, I went off to Fisk believing that. I went to Oberlin believing that. But one day, I ended up in a classroom that turned that upside down. I had asked my friends at Oberlin to help me find a course in the catalog that did not meet before 10 o'clock a.m. I wanted a course where the prof was said not to be a bore, and I wanted a course that would help me satisfy my social science requirements. So somebody said, take this. And in the catalog, I tell you, Brother Gerald, I had to sound out the last word. It said, Introduction to Cultural Anthropology.
Yes.
At the end of that first class, I said, Goodbye, Pediatrics. Hello, Anthropology.
Wow.
I had been so smitten in that classroom by Professor George Eaton Simpson, who had done his field work in your native land of Jamaica, who was a student of the well-known Melville J. Herskovitz, who of course pioneered in the very notion of African retentions in the so-called New World.
Yes.
So that is how I was introduced to cultural anthropology. It was such an introduction that stuck. There was no anthropology major at Oberlin. So I majored in sociology, but the truth of the matter is I majored in George Eaton Simpson.
Okay. And he had that profound of an impact on you.
Extraordinary impact.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I am so moved by the fact that after his passing, his daughter sent me some of those little bitty slides from his original field work in Jamaica that he willed to me. And so when it was time for graduate school, there was no question. I would go where Professor Simpson sent me. And Professor Simpson said, you will go and study with the great Melville J. Herskovitz in the African Studies program and and be a student for your master's in anthropology at Northwestern.
That is, and you had both a master's and your doctoral work was done there at Northwestern, correct?
It's true. That is true.
So after that, I imagine after completing those studies, did you go straight into the classroom? Because you then started teaching at UMass.
No, my first appointment after doing my field work for 2 years in Liberia.
Oh, okay.
Was at the University of, but at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington.
Right, right.
The appointment was in anthropology. However, with colleagues there, and now it's the early 1960s, 1964, I had the responsibility with others of founding one of the first Black Studies programs in the United States.
Yes. And that Dr. Cole, I think, is not only one of your signatures on your what we call your vibration that you will leave in on this earth is what you've started, because you pretty much started programs wherever you went. I believe the W.E.B. Du Bois Department at the University of Massachusetts, you had a hand in that as well. What was that like as W.E.B. Du Bois as a scholar and his early on debates with other contemporaries and the pros and cons of his argument? How did you land on W.E.B. Du Bois?
Well, I guess I just have to say the good Lord, she sent me there. Where there was an exceptional convening of Black intellectuals and activists. Assembled at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I mean, I'm going to call names like Michael Thelwell from your country, the Jamaican scholar of literature and social justice activists. The amazingly productive historian John Bracey, an education Brother Chester. It was a place where Max Roach and Archie Shepp and Acklin Lynch came to work. I'm thinking of Nelson. I'm thinking of Nelson Stevens, who was a part of Afro Cobra, that collaborative of African artists. African-centered artists. I mean, it was an extraordinary place of Black intellectualism and activism, to which W.E.B. Du Bois's wife, Shirley Graham Du Bois, came to be a visiting professor.
Wow.
They came when my colleagues asked me if I would take the lead in going to welcome an amazingly distinguished new colleague who we had invited to come among us, and he had accepted with his family. Chinua Achebe was a part of that W.E.B. Du Bois department. And as you may know today, it is one of the distinguished, productive departments in that discipline that we call Afro-American or African-American studies.
Yes, yes, ma'am. Yes, indeed. You just called the name, and I got, I don't have any hair on my head now, but my hair almost stood up. Chinua Achebe, he's the author of my favorite book, Things Fall Apart. And, you know, I try to get my children to read that book. They read it and loved it. But growing up in Jamaica, that was part of our English literature repertoire that we had to read coming up in high school. But as an educator, you took a lot of what you've, because as an educator, you created a lot. And then eventually you became a president of Spelman College. And that's when I think nationally and internationally, most of us heard your name is the association with Spelman. So what was that like? And when you look at Spelman today, what comes to mind for you?
Well, first of all, I have to share this with you. I had no interest in serving as the president of Spelman College.
Really? Okay.
In fact, I remember so well having been in Brazil. I was there being of assistance to a dear, dear friend, Betty Forbes, who's the life partner of the wonderful Brother Reverend James Forbes. Mm-hmm. And I'd been in Brazil assisting Betty Forbes with the choir, the ecumenical choir from Riverside Church. And I came back to my office at Hunter College. And when I walked in to my office, there was a note from the president, Donna Shalala. Johnetta, see me immediately when you return. Donna, typical Donna Shalala. And there was another note. Johnetta, I need to speak to you ASAP. Marion. That note was from Marion Wright Edelman.
Oh, now wow.
The Children's Defense Fund. Great early civil rights activists.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, the chair of the board of Spelman College. Well, each of those women, even though I am actually older than either, each had been serving as a mentor to me over the years. The message I got from both Sister President Donna Shalala and Sister Chair of the Board Marion Wright Edelman was the same. You will apply for the presidency of Spelman. And though my first response was, why would I want to do that? I'm a happy professor.
Mm-hmm.
Mentors often see in their mentees what the mentees cannot see in themselves.
Yes, ma'am.
And so, of course, I am eternally grateful to my two mentors for having seen in me the possibility that I could be at the helm of that historically Black college for women. And not only at the helm, but to be there as the very first Black woman to president that school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to give you just a little bit of anthropology here.
Okay.
Not during the trip when I was in Brazil, being of assistance to my dear friend Betty Forbes. But on my first trip to Brazil, after I had finished the work that I had been doing, which was working with students from across CUNY, the City University of New York system, in a program that looked at Brazil and at the United States, enslavement in Brazil, enslavement in the United States, the role of women in Brazil, in the United States, back and forth, a wonderful comparative experience for CUNY students. At the end of which, a colleague who is Brazilian said, Janetta, and she's also an anthropologist, would you like to go for a reading? Well, come on, if you're an anthropologist and you're a Brazilian, are you going to turn down a reading? Uh-uh. So Silvita said, I'll pick you up. And off we went to see a very well-known individual who was said to be able to see into the future. Her name, Maruca. And so Silvita drives me to Maruca's home, working class neighborhood. This is Sao Paulo. We get out of the car, we walk into this very modest working class home, and the little space is filled with women waiting their turn to have Maruca tell them something of their future.
Wow.
And so one of the women said to Silvita in Portuguese, I commanded no Portuguese, and I did command a reasonable amount of Spanish, so I could kind of pick it up. This is the stranger, she must go first. And so we all sat, and at a given moment, the door opened. My brother, it was like a force entered the room, and it was Maruca. And she looked at Silvita, and she looked at me, and she simply did like this. And we walked into her bedroom. Maruca sat at the end of her bed. There was a trunk between her bed and two chairs. And I sat in one, and Silvita in the other. And because I do not speak Portuguese, Maruca said to Silvita, and Silvita then said to me, Ella dice como tú te llamas. What is your name? I said, me llamo Janetta. Maruca didn't say another word. She just grabbed some cowries. And I had already seen those cowries on this table. I had seen a snake plant. I had seen a wooden piece like this. I had seen cowrie shells. I'd seen a glass of water. And my anthropology could identify each of these objects as things that Maruca would use to see into my future.
Mm.
And so she grabbed the cowries. And I, again, because I'm an anthropologist, I know about this sort of thing. I knew she was going to distribute the cowries. And then depending on the relationship of how many were up, how many were down, in what configuration, she would read my future.
Mm.
She grabbed the cowries, and as she was about to release them, she became possessed. And that's something I knew about. Not only because I grew up in Mount Olive AME Mount Olive AME Church, but because I'd done my master's thesis on Africanisms in a Black church on the south side of Chicago. And I knew what happened when someone became possessed. And so I sat there calmly as I watched Maruka. And then she came out of it.
Mm.
She released the cowries. She took her hand. This is a Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at me and she said in Portuguese, as Silvita translated for me, "You, when you return to your country," and she did like this, "you will become the leader of a place where Black women like us rarely lead."
Wow, wow, wow.
Say, I'm looking at Silvita. What is this woman talking about? I'm about to go back down to college where I teach anthropology and women's studies and head the Caribbean and Latin American Studies program for CUNY. What is Maruka talking about?
Right, right.
Let me put it together in case you can't do it. Maruka had seen what Donna Shalala and Marion Wright Edelman told me I was to do. Let me finish this story quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Once I was appointed to the presidency of Spelman, I had to get back to Brazil. And fortunately, my dearest friends, Reverend Forbes and Betty Forbes, asked me to come back to Brazil, not to Sao Paulo, but to Rio. But once I got to Rio, did what I needed to do for Betty Forbes, I took myself a plane to Sao Paulo to see Maruka.
Mm.
I found Silvita. We drove up. As the universe would have it, just as we're getting out of Silvita's car, so is Maruka. I see her and I started screaming, "Maruka, Maruka, wait until I tell you." She said, "Shh, I know."
Oh, wow. 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 So did Maruka, you think, would have seen not only Spelman, but would have seen Bennett and would have seen the National Council of Negro Women, because you led those organizations as well. And quite honestly, you've left your mark everywhere that you've been. So you are what I call a transformational leader. And I tell people all the time, yourself and Dr. Dorothy Kauser Yancey, I keep saying, are some of the greatest to ever have done it. But do you think Maruka's epiphany or look into the future covered that broad spectrum in your career?
You know, each of us will decide for ourselves what we think is that line between the natural and the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Each of us must make our own decision as to what we believe an individual like Maruka is able to sense and feel and see. All I can say to you is that I think we know so little about that line and that crossing of the line between the natural and the supernatural worlds. I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, I think that is a very astute point, Dr. Cole. So I want to switch a little bit and ask you about administration in the context of, before we got on air, I mentioned the name of Dr. William H. Gray and the UNCF and what he means to me, or meant to me as a professional in the higher education space. But when you think about it, you mentioned Dr. Bethune co-founding UNCF. Mr. Gray brought me to UNCF. Well, what does that organization mean to you? Because now I just read recently that you're going to be co-chairing the effort to the $1 billion campaign. So you're back in the family, if you will, of extending the legacy of the United Negro College Fund. What does that organization mean? And anything that you'd like to share about Bill Gray and your time with him?
Well, first of all, William Gray, the Reverend William Gray, the exceptional leader of UNCF, William Gray, is not just to be remembered, but to be cherished.
Yes, ma'am.
And for you, I know that that has meaning because you worked with and for him. For me, I can only say that I know I could not have done what, with others, I managed to do at Bennett College without William Gray. Excuse me. You know, he had a way about him that, in my view, combined being a very methodical thinker and doer around garnering resources, and a very spiritual way of getting that work done.
Mm-hmm.
So I will always treasure my relationship with the great Bill Gray. I am not sure when I'm going to wake up and do what some say I should do, which is to retire. Because I seem to be on a roll of getting F minus as the grade I get in retirement.
Yes, ma'am.
And so I thought I had basically edged up on doing a lot less. And then I took on an extraordinary project as one of the fellows of the Kettering Foundation. Then I said, okay, now I know that's it. Clearing my plate of a lot of other things. Oh, and here comes Michael Lomax.
Yes, ma'am.
And Michael Lomax, the brother president of the UNCF, and I have known each other and worked together for many, many years. And when Michael came to visit with me, along with Senior Vice President Mark Barnes from UNCF, they made such a compelling case that I knew that I really needed to do this work. And so I agreed to be the fourth co-chair of UNCF's, and I have to stop and get my lips ready to say this word, $1 billion campaign.
Yes, ma'am.
Other co-chairs are Michael Lomax himself, the brother chair of the board of UNCF, just an extraordinary community leader and professionally a banker, Milton Jones, the first African American to chair UNCF Sports.
Yes, ma'am.
And then thirdly, Brother President French, who is the president of Clark Atlanta University and the convener and president of the member presidents.
Yes, ma'am.
And so I am the fourth co-chair. Now, while that is a mighty, 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 mighty big figure of $1 billion, UNCF has been in a silent phase, and we are doing very well. We're halfway there. Now, often in a campaign, in the silent phase, it's the easiest of the phases.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get public, it's a harder lift, let me use that image. But I'm convinced that it will happen for UNCF. And importantly, there is a part of this campaign that was really why I agreed to do this. And it is a part of the $1 billion campaign is that each of the 37 member institutions will receive a grant which they must match that will go into their endowments.
Yes, ma'am.
And set them on the road for the future. I believe so deeply in the importance of endowments in solidifying the financial future of our institutions.
Yes, ma'am.
So that is the work that we are going to do. It's righteous work.
Yes, ma'am. I've been very blessed. I'm a Howard grad, and I've served as a CFO at Johnson C. Smith and Morehouse College. Believe it or not, my mentor in higher education was Danny Flanagan. When I got into higher education, Dr. Yancey made him and E. Dean Montgomery my mentors. And I remember picking up my staff from Johnson C. Smith and all of us getting into a 15-seater van and driving down to Atlanta, Georgia from Charlotte. And Danny took us for 2 days. He took me around and showed me everything. And I'm eternally grateful for them. But when you think about HBCUs today, I often get asked the question, are they still needed and relevant? And obviously my answer is going to be biased, but it's not only biased because of where I went to school or where I worked. It's just the nature of where we are and what they stand for in the population that they serve. So I just want to ask you this question, being starting at Fisk, coming back to being president of Spelman and president of Bennett, as you look on that continuum from when you were a student to where you sit today now, one of four co-chairs, how do you see HBCUs and their evolving nature over that time?
I'm going to use an expression that I use so often when I was at Spelman and at Bennett. And it's not an expression centered in our HBCUs, but I would say it about UNCF because after all, UNCF consists of member institutions that are HBCUs.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's this. If UNCF did not exist today, it would be necessary to invent it.
Wow.
Which is my way of saying that even though UNCF began in 1944, we are celebrating 80 years of this organization. It is as needed today as it was in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that every Black or student of color, or in some cases, some white students will go to HBCUs and the member institutions of UNCF. But what it does mean is that for countless families and their children, there is a future of productivity, of joy, and of service because they have been molded at an HBCU that is a UNCF member institution. So we've got to raise the rest of this money because it is what solidifies the future of these institutions.
Yes, ma'am. I so agree with you. I try my best to give back in ways that I can by sharing the same way Danny Flanagan poured into me is to pour into others by teaching. Dr. French has a program that Dr. Phyllis Dawkins runs on the Clark Atlanta campus, the HBCU Executive Leadership Institute. I so happen to be a faculty member, and it's always interesting to see all the folks that are coming through wanting to be leaders in HBCUs. It's heartwarming, to say the least. Well, Dr. Cole, we have about 5 minutes left. And I wanted to ask you, just in a general sense, I've done this with several of my guests before. You have had such an illustrious career, and you have impacted so many people over the course of your career. But as an educator, as an administrator, and all the things that you've accomplished, to the audience that's listening today, what words of hope and inspiration that you could leave with us, given where we are in this dispensation in time in our nation, in our world, geopolitically, internationally, whatever it may be? We're seeing what's happening in Haiti right now. Our heart hurts for that. But just wanted to see what words would you leave for the young people, or maybe the young adults and the audience that listens to this podcast?
Well, I want to be fully transparent and say that of all the years that I've lived, or in all of the years that I've lived, and there are 87 of them, this period is unusually frightening. Without using language to be dramatic, I can say that I think there's overwhelming evidence that American democracy is under attack. And that Americans, most vulnerable citizens, and that means Black folk and other folk of color, and that means LGBTQ question mark folk, are just under assault. I mean, I have to almost each day recite to myself so that it's clear. I live in a country where books are banned. I live in a country where individuals, because they are professionals in the diversity, equity, accessibility, and inclusion space, can just be summarily dismissed and have been. I live in a country where school boards are saying what teachers can and cannot say and teach. This is not Nazi Germany. This is not Italy under Mussolini. This is not other totalitarian European countries. This is the United States of America. And so, to those of us who, as a great civil rights leader put it, those of us who believe in freedom must continue to do. We must stay in this struggle. And that means, most fundamentally, in my view, we have got to vote. Like our lives depend on it, because they do. We have got to push back always nonviolently against these assaults on marginalized communities. We must find a way to make sure that we and our children continue to read about, to feel about, to know about our own history and her story and their story. So these are very frightening times. But as Ella Baker said, we who believe in freedom will not rest until it comes.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cole. I will give you the honor of any closing remarks or anything you'd like to share. Believe it or not, the audience that listens to these podcasts, I'm told, are grandparents trying to necessarily get their young ones to understand that the guests that I've had on here, Andrew Young, Edwin Moses, Otis Moss, to name a few, David Thomas, Beverly Tatum, Dorothy Yancey, all of these folks have shared their stories. And believe it or not, it's just you sharing today that inspires so many people to say, I could do what Dr. Cole has done. So I'll give you the final closing words if there's anything that you'd like to share.
Well, I think I'm going to come full circle back to some of the earlier comments we were making about my hero, Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune. There's so much that she has said and written to us that is memorable. But I'm thinking about these words of Dr. Bethune. She said, without faith, nothing is possible. With faith, nothing is impossible. And so I would just let my words be, as we bring closure, we have to keep the faith. But as the great book says, faith without action is dead.
Yes, ma'am.
And that is why we have got to be so informed, so politically active in these troubled times. I want to thank you for just having this conversation with me, and know that I wish you well.
Thank you so much. Coming from you, Dr. Cole, that is a deep honor, deep, deep honor. And as I was sitting here listening to you, I have to definitely send you a copy of my book. And I want to make sure that I autograph it well. And just to say thank you for doing this. I know you're an extremely busy lady. And Aaron, Mr. Cole, really, I give him a lot of thanks as well for making this happen. So thank you so much. I'm deeply honored and eternally grateful for you spending some time with me. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. We've just spent the last hour with Dr. Janetta Cole, and you heard the stories, you heard the word, the wisdom, and all the things that those of us that have been observing her from a distance and just being inspired by her journey, and more importantly, her witness. We oftentimes forget about that. Listening to words is great, but listening and observing the way someone carries themselves and the way in which they impact others is more inspirational than anything else that we could imagine. So I hope that something was said, a word shared, or something that pricked the nerve that say, I can do this as well. So remember, this is It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And until next week, take care and God bless.